You're listening to Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. We've all seen those wacky science fiction movies, right, where someone is practicing mind control. They're wearing what looks like a shower cap with lots of wires coming out of it. Well, it's fiction no more, and not just a Hollywood creation. Try the Journal of Neuroscience. Here's how it works. When we think, our brains generate electrical signals, so when you move your hand forward, you make one signal pattern. You move it back, you make another. Well, for the first time, researchers are able to monitor and decode these signals without having to implant anything in your brain. No tiny little wire electrodes like these to have to do that. Instead, they are listening with the EEG sensors on the scalp. And my next guest translated these electrical signals into three-dimensional hand motion. And now he's working on feeding those signals into a computer to drive a mouse. In fact, you can see his apparatus on our website at sciencefriday.com. Jose Contreras-Vidal is also an author of the new study and is professor in the Department of Kinesiology and the graduate program in neuroscience and cognitive science at the University of Maryland in College Park. Welcome to Science Friday, Professor Vidal.
Hi, Ira. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. So what breakthrough did you have to do to just be able to put the electrodes on the scalp instead of sticking wires inside?
Yes. For a long time, has been thought that the information content and the amount of noise in EEG signals, which are measured outside the scalp, were a limiting factor for extracting useful information. And we never thought that possibility. So what we have shown now is that, in fact, it's possible to extract useful information from your brain using these sensors that are non-invasive.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Contreras-Vidal, did you come up with this yourself, or was this something that's taken a while to work out?
We started in this area since 2004, doing some preliminary work in terms of the signal processing, the algorithms that we use to clean the signals and mm-hmm. to extract the information required.
Mm-hmm. And your aim is to then just to create devices that if you think about it, it will happen.
Well, that's certainly one application, but the applications go beyond that. Mm-hmm. For example, because we now understand better how movement is represented in the brain at the micro scale afforded by EEG, we can compare that, for example, during motor development in children, or we can compare that with patterns that might be affected by Parkinson's disease, mm-hmm. and so on and so mm-hmm. forth.
And they have different motions. I'm guessing from your work and reading your paper, different motions show distinctive signals.
Well, let me tell you how this works. So we recorded this the brain activity from many sensors on the head, and at the same time as we recorded the motion of the hand. Now, we developed a decoder or an algorithm that basically extracts information from many sensors and integrates that information also in the recent past. And when you combine all those signals, then using our algorithm, it's possible to predict when your hand is going to be in a space in the next time.
And you can predict that just from the experience you have with recording the brainwaves.
Exactly.
Hmm. Can you?
And so something that's very interesting is that we found that the contribution, the greatest contribution to the decoding located over a very important area of the brain for motor control, which is sensory motor area. And this activity was 60 milliseconds ahead of the movement of the hand, which is consistent with the delays from the processing in cortex of the motor command, the transmission of this signal through the spinal cord, and then finally reaching the muscle.
Yeah, it took time for the signal to get to the hand from the brain.
Exactly.
Why the hand? Is that because it has so many signals all the time coming from it? We use it so much. Why choose the hand as an area to study?
Yeah, well, the hand is you know is a very important part of the body that we use every day for you know reaching, grasping, and combing your hair. But also, it's a part of the body that has been used extensively by invasive studies that where you place electrodes inside your brain. So we wanted to be able to compare our algorithm to the invasive ones.
Mm-hmm. Now, I mentioned before that one of your aims is to try to get people to think about, to think and move a mouse, a computer mouse, by thinking about it. Is that possible?
Yeah, that's correct. And in fact, one of my students, Trent Bradbury, who is the student leader in this paper, we are now and doing exactly what you said. We are asking persons to think about moving, and you know, we record these signals and we use those signals to control the computer mouse. And we hope that within the next few months we are able to demonstrate this application. Mm.
A question from Second Life from Tiger Paw says, could this set a new standard when determining if someone is truly brain dead?
let me tell you that one advantage of using EEG is that because we are recording from many parts of the brain, and because we know that movement is represented in multiple ways in the brain, so there are multiple representations for movement, then even if one part of the brain has suffered injury or has been damaged, then we can still extract signal from other parts of the brain. So I think that's an advantage that we have using EEG, because we see the whole brain, basically. Mm.
Let's go to Jessica in Augusta, Kansas. Hi, Jessica.
Hi. Thanks for having me on the show.
You're welcome. Go ahead.
I had a question, I guess, kind of differentiating your thoughts. I mean, you know, you always have one of those experiences where you're sitting on the couch and thinking, man, I could really use a sandwich. And you want a sandwich, but you don't get up and do it. And then there's that time when you decide, okay, I'm going to get up, I'm going to do it. How would you be able to differentiate those different desires using your technology?
Good question.
Yeah, excellent question. And it's something that's very important for the practical implementation of brain-machine interfaces. We want to have multitasking capability. So we walk and, you know, reach the drink of glass of water and call our friends. So, you know, there's a lot of information that could contaminate the signal you are interested in decoding. Now, in our experiment, you know, we ask subjects, our participants to self-select the targets to aim and also decide when to move their arm. So there was, some aspect of decision making in terms of selection of the target, and also timing the movement, not only the movement itself. So this study already demonstrate that it is possible to extract information from hand motion, at least, even in the presence of other type of information, for example, decision making and so on and so forth.
Jessica, thanks.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Do you ever think about testing this out on people who have disabilities, on people with Lou Gehrig's disease who have trouble, you know, they're still awake and they're aware? I'm thinking of Stephen Hawking type people who might be able to move things now.
That's our next step. Clearly, an assistive device like this will be very helpful for people with disability, for example, spinal cord injury or stroke. I think you mentioned that, so that's in our plans, and we hope to be able to report on that too. Mm.
Are there some people's who signals are easier to decode than other people?
That's an interesting question. We in fact found that the decoding accuracy of our method depended on the quality of the movement. Okay, the way I like to explain this is that you can imagine, you know, a major league baseball player who, you know, performs perhaps hundreds of throws, you know.
A pitcher, right. Somebody
yeah,
else.
Pitcher, you know, every day compared to you know, to a person just like me or perhaps you that, you know, that we don't get yeah, to
you
throw that
You throw your gum away once a day or something.
Right. So, so that baseball player, you know, has achieved a high level of skill mm-hmm. in doing that particular, performing that particular action, and we expect the representation of that move in the brain to be very well refined and also, you know, very highly consolidated. With respect to the motor program for a naive person, and so what our results suggest is that the decoding of the movement by the baseball player will be easier, you know, will mm-hmm. be with greater accuracy. However, this also indicates that once you connect a device with our algorithm, that you could train the person, you know, to regain a level of skill with the interface that will be comfortable to him or
yeah.
to her.
Yeah, you sort of practice that action.
Exactly.
Then. Yeah, you think so that think about doing it, then you say yes, a little different, a little more. You got it almost, you know, that sort of
yeah.
thing.
I mean, the brain is a highly plastic, you know, structure, and it likes to get better at doing things. So we can benefit, we can profit from the plasticity of the brain to
right.
Try to incorporate the interface, the machine, the assistive right. device in our brain. Yeah.
Well, let me ask that a corollary to that question. What if you have an area of the brain that's damaged? Could you train a different area to take over that spot?
And right. That's also an excellent question. So I mentioned before that from prior studies has been shown that the representation of movement in the brain are multiple. You know, different right. areas of the brain can be used in principle to extract this information. So even if you have a lesion, you know, a stroke in primary motor cortex, which is associated with the production of movement, you could still use other areas that carry information about movement as well.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Mike in South Bend. Hi, Mike.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Was basically just wondering, I've been hearing a lot about recording the brain function of certain people and being able to map that out. And let's say you took the brain function and the brain activity of an expert guitar player and recorded that, and then maybe, basically my question is there a way that maybe in the future they could take that information and put it into somebody that's never played the guitar before, and all of a sudden they'd be an expert because they've got that recorded function?
Hmm.
Well, yeah, that's an interesting thought. What I suppose could be done is to know the knowledge that we have about how this representation for movement look like in terms of brain activity, compare that to, you know, for rehabilitation purposes with, you know, with an individual that does they have that skill or have a normal movement, and try to devise a method to restore the pattern of activity. So, you know, in principle, if, you know, it might be possible to reshape the pattern of activity using some other techniques.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flato here talking with Jose Contreras-Vidal, who is author of a new study about brain control of limbs and things. And of course, people are going to want to know, Professor, when they're going to be able to see some practical results from this sort of thing. Right?
Yeah,
I bet you get that asked every 10 minutes.
Yes, that's correct. And as I said before, we are working hard on that, and we hope that within a few months we will be able to demonstrate a brain-computer interface that can be driven by thought alone.
So it's in experimental stages right now.
Right. We are basically we're trying to uncover, you know, what's the best way to train our decoder algorithm. Mm. What's the best way to link the brain signals to the machine?
What about a mind controlled robot? You know, the whole robot you can control with thinking about.
So one application is, for example, thinking about a below elbow amputee that would like to restore hand function.
Mm-hmm.
So we are pursuing studies that attempt to decode the gestures of the hand, for example, when you grasp an object. And so we, in principle, could use those signals to drive a robotic arm or hand. And that's one of the applications that we are also very interested.
Mm-hmm. And I imagine that there must be other laboratories, and this must be a hot topic of research these days.
Yeah, there are laboratories around the world that many of them focusing on the invasive mm-hmm. methods, but some of them are also using EEG and signals and some mm-hmm. other non-invasive type of signals. Until now, it hasn't been shown that this is possible to do with EEG. Right. In terms of the complexity of the movement that we demonstrate.
Can you decode other types of feelings that are not related to movement? Maybe, sadness or happy or depression or anything like that?
In principle, it's possible to decode other internal states of the brain, as you mentioned, mm-hmm. Stress or fear. And together with colleagues here at the University of Maryland, we are exactly looking at that question. We hope to come with that.
But the big take home from what we're talking about is the technology, right? That you don't have to invasively stick wires in people's brains anymore. You can record and decode what these things, from like the old things you see in the sci-fi movies, the shower cap with the wires coming out of it, right? Much more complex than that?
Right. Yeah, I think that's the take home message from this work that it is possible to use a non-invasive method to extract information that can be used to control an assistive device. And that basically eliminates all the potential risks associated with surgery or with implanting an array of electrodes inside your brain, which makes it possible to think about applications in clinical populations are at risk, like children and the elderly.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wish you luck. And
thank you very much.
And do you need a new kind of a shower cap? Do you have to develop anything new in that technology, or is it all there?
Well, there's a different type of caps available, and that doesn't seem to be really a critical problem.
Yeah, that's not the limiting factor here.
No, that's not the limiting factor.
Okay, Professor, thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Jose Contreras-Vidal is an author of this new study that was out talking about the EEG sensors on a scalp, and he's a professor in the Department of Kinesiology and the graduate program in neuroscience and cognitive science at the University of Maryland in College Park.